support by Israel, which had tasked Iran with controlling the Amal movement. However, the situation continued to deteriorate. On April 12, 1968, Tamur Bakhtiar visited Lebanon, as he had done on previous occasions. This time, however, he was arrested by Lebanese forces. The Shah, attempting to secure Bakhtiar's return, offered several million dollars in bribes to the Lebanese authorities and promised a special plane for his transfer under complete control. Despite these efforts, the Lebanese authorities refused to hand over Bakhtiar. Imam Musa Sadr intervened, asking the Lebanese authorities to release Bakhtiar, and his mediation led to Bakhtiar's eventual release. The Shah's attempt to arrest Bakhtiar and establish a successful relationship with Imam Musa Sadr and Chamran had failed. More importantly, Savak and Mossad were concerned about Imam Musa Sadr's growing influence among various Lebanese communities. With Sadr's power increasing, Israel had no choice but to kidnap Imam Musa Sadr. On August 31, 1978, Imam Musa Sadr traveled to Libya at the invitation of Muammar Gaddafi. After that trip, no one saw Imam Musa Sadr again. The Lebanese authorities pursued the matter, but Gaddafi claimed that Imam Musa Sadr had left Libya for Rome, a claim Italy immediately refuted. Despite frequent discussions, Lebanon was ultimately deprived of Imam Musa Sadr. A few months later, the Iranian Revolution would overthrow the monarchical regime allied with Israel. In Imam Musa Sadr's absence, the youth of Amal had only one hope, Dr. Chamran. However, with the victory of the Iranian Revolution, Chamran returned to Iran to serve his homeland, for which he had tirelessly worked to liberate. Upon Chamran's arrival in Iran, Amal's youths followed, utilizing their experiences from Lebanon to establish the headquarters of irregular warfare. The bond between Iran and Lebanon was stronger than Israel could have imagined. The roots cultivated over years under the shadow of Mossad and Savak had emerged. Consequently, Israel concluded that its survival depended on an attack on Lebanon to achieve its objectives there. January 6, 1982. As Iran and Iraq were deeply engaged in a war, Israel entered Lebanon under the pretext of combating Palestinian resistance movements. Israel occupied the Shia areas in southern Lebanon, resulting in the displacement of hundreds of thousands of people. The Maronite Christian forces, known as the Phalangs, aligned with Israel, making Lebanon unsafe for Shias and Palestinian resistance forces in the northern regions. The Amal movement forces emerged as the sole protectors of the Lebanese in this dire situation. Urban warfare had been raging in Lebanon for several months. Meanwhile, Iran was focused on fighting and recapturing its cities. These efforts culminated on May 24, 1982, with the liberation of Khorramshahr, Iran's most significant fallen city, which had become a symbol of resistance. After reclaiming Khorramshahr, Iranian forces began to concentrate their efforts beyond their borders, with Lebanon becoming a new focal point for them. June 13, 1982, Iran, in coordination with the Supreme Council of Defense, sent forces from the Muhammad Rasulullah Brigade under the command of Ahmad Mutawassilian to Lebanon. The brigade's mission was to assist Lebanese forces and fight against Israel. Initially, the Iranian forces were deployed to Damascus and then transferred to Lebanon via land routes. A few days after their arrival, Imam Khomeini became aware of their presence and, prioritizing the Iranian fronts, ordered their return to Iran. Consequently, the Muhammad Rasulullah Brigade returned to Iran and was stationed on Iran's fronts. However, Ahmad Mutawassilian and several other commanders remained in Lebanon to complete their mission. Mutawassilian, one of the most experienced Iranian commanders, had extensive combat experience from the war in Iran's Kurdistan against the so-called Democratic Party, making him adept at leading urban warfare and organizing forces. These capabilities had gone unnoticed by Israel. The presence of such a commander in Lebanon was concerning for Israel. With no news of Imam Musa Sadr and Dr. Chamran, Ahmed Mutavassilian established a new line of resistance in Lebanon. July 4, 1982. A meeting was held at the Iranian embassy in Beirut to evaluate the activities and achievements of Ahmed Mutavassilian and the Muhammad Rasulullah Brigade in Lebanon. It was decided that all remaining groups of Iranian troops in Lebanon would travel to Damascus on July 6th and return to Iran. Sayed Mohsen Mousavi, the chargé d'affaires of the Iranian embassy, suggested that before returning, they could visit Baalbek and the suburbs of Beirut to inspect the region and prepare a report. On the morning of July 5, 1982, Ahmed Mutavassilian, Iranian diplomat Mousavi, and two Iranian journalists, Taghir Astigar Mughaddam and Kazem Akhavan, were heading to the outskirts of Beirut. On their way to a checkpoint, they encountered Falange forces, who were waiting for them. This was the last known information about the passengers of the Iranian diplomatic car in Lebanon. After that, no one heard from them again, similar to what had happened with Imam Musa Sadr. The movement formed by the presence of Iranian forces in Lebanon would soon reshape relations between Lebanon and the region. A new force would be established in Lebanon, which would not only become a significant chapter for Lebanese movements like Amal, but also open a new chapter in the confrontation with Israel.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Five centuries of Western domination of the world is coming to an end. This will be the century of Asia, Eurasia, and Africa. India should strategize accordingly. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, "To be an enemy of America can be dangerous, but to be a friend is fatal." These are purportedly the words of Henry Kissinger, the notorious war criminal and Nobel Peace Prize winner who greatly influenced American foreign policy. India must not forget this dark side of the American establishment, even though Joe Biden claimed that U.S.-India relations are the most consequential of this century. And Donald Trump has repeatedly met with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, calling him a great leader. The U.S. pivot to India is undergirded by three American interests: containment of China, cheap labor, and a vast consumer market. The United States has no real allies, only narcissistic and imperialist interests. Modi was one of the few foreign leaders invited to the White House during the first month of Trump's new administration. Overall, Indians also have very positive opinions about Trump and the United States in general. There are many reasons why the United States enjoys significant soft power in India. Immigration, tech jobs, the success of Indian Americans, the popularity of the English language, Western funding of Indian think tanks, American investors in Indian corporate media, tensions with China, and so on. However, India, a rising global power, must be careful not to turn into the Ukraine of Asia, an expendable geopolitical pawn of the United States empire. Let us be blunt. The U.S. wants to control every aspect of India. A few months ago, the U.S. ambassador to India told an Indian audience that there is no such thing as a strategic autonomy. Ominously, this warning came just before the U.S. staged the color revolution in Bangladesh and overthrew Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina Wajid, who was not perfect, but had done a commendable job in reviving the economy. The reason was simple. PM Hasina refused to allow a U.S. military base in her country. Similarly, any objective geopolitical analyst could see how the U.S. staged coups in Pakistan and Sri Lanka in the past few days. Incarcerated Prime Minister Imran Khan was ousted by a soft coup after blatant U.S. pressure. His party was banned and he was sent to prison. How about that for American-style freedom and democracy? His crime was to be too friendly to Russia. As for Sri Lanka, the party in power was deemed to be too pro-China. Of course, the United States could not allow such independence. History also reveals that the United States was never a true ally of India. While the Indian foreign policy establishment is wary of China's influence in India's neighborhood, there is almost no outcry about American meddling in India's sphere of influence. Indians are too forgiving about the fact that in 1966, the US CIA luckily assassinated Indian Prime Minister Lal Bahadur Shastri and the top nuclear scientist Homi Bhabha. All through the Cold War, the United States sabotaged India as a punishment for the latter's non-alignment philosophy and friendly relations with the USSR. The United States also encouraged India to start a war with China over Tibet. But then President JFK refused to provide any military assistance at this critical moment. Later, when Bangladesh sought independence, the United States sent warships to the Bay of Bengal to threaten India, which was able to repel the Americans only with the help of the Soviet Union. Fast forward to today, India has not really benefited from its close relations with America. When the Cold War ended, American corporations salivated over China and India to be exploited for cheap labor in manufacturing and services, respectively. However, the difference in these two countries could not be starker. While China focused on mastering technologies and creating indigenous champions, Indian elites were content with using American products. The result could be seen in Chinese tech giants such as Huawei, BYD, ByteDance, and 135 other companies in the Fortune 500 list, compared to just 9 from India. In artificial intelligence, the most disruptive technology of this century, China owns 60% of the patents, while India accounts for less than 1%. In numerous other industries, including electric cars, solar panels, batteries, smartphones, semiconductors, robotics, cloud computing, biotech, space travel, fighter jets, warships, etc., China has far surpassed India. Why has India fallen behind? Because we follow the American economic model of financialized capitalism, and we feel safe with dependency on the American dollar, American technology, American media, American medicine, American investment, and so on. India also allows its foreign policy to be dictated by the United States more than necessary. For example, we could be buying cheap oil and gas from Iran, and we could have started the Chabahar port project a long time ago. However, India is too differential towards U.S. sanctions. Similarly, India joining the Quad and other Indo-Pacific agreements to contain China or refusing to join the Belt and Road Initiative only promotes the U.S. geopolitical machinations of divide and rule. Right now, the U.S. benefits from India in multiple ways, relatively inexpensive Indian labor in the software industry, ultra-cheap manufacturing labor for companies like Apple, a giant consumer market of growing middle class, Indian startups being open to American investors, Indian government's purchase of U.S. weapons, and India being a potential geopolitical tool to contain China diplomatically, economically, and militarily. However, American soft power will not last long in India. First, the United States will soon restrict immigration from India, especially for H-1B tech workers. The racist American alt-right has already started demonizing Indians. Second, the United States will start containing India as the latter continues to grow and become more independent. The United States may allow Indians to become CEOs of Google and Microsoft, but the U.S. will not tolerate Indian companies that compete with Google and Microsoft. The U.S. maintains its global hegemony not because of equal partners, but through a network of vassals. Even Europeans are finally waking up from their hypernotic slumber. The new German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, said that Europe must work towards independence from the United States. Looking at the big picture, we are witnessing the cycle of history in which another empire is on the verge of collapse. However, unlike the last few centuries, the United States will not be replaced by another empire. Instead, a multipolar world is emerging to democratize geopolitics and geoeconomy. Organizations like BRICS will provide a new paradigm of cooperation and development for the Global South nations. Also gone will be the extraordinary privilege of the U.S. dollar, which underpins American tyranny of sanctions and endless wars. 5 centuries of Western domination of the world is coming to an end. This will be the century of Asia, Eurasia, and Africa. India should strategize accordingly.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
South Africa's iconic freedom fighter and first democratically elected leader, Nelson Mandela, once remarked, "We know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians." So how can the International Quds Day be utilized as a strategic platform to further Mandela's vision of a free Palestine and work towards realizing his dream? And to discuss the International Quds Day and Africa's support for the liberation of Palestine, we are joined by Dr. Feroz Osman. He is the executive member of Media Review Network. We are also joined by Hassan Loget. He is the co-founder of Media Justice Africa. The International Quds Day is observed annually on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan. Established by Imam Khomeini in 1979, this popular occasion serves as a global expression of solidarity with the Palestinian people in their struggle against the Israeli apartheid regime and its ongoing atrocities. Quds Day has united voices worldwide in support of Palestine, and today, Africa has emerged as a formidable resistance force against the Israeli genocidal regime. Despite intense U.S. pressure and Israeli attempts to infiltrate the continent, Africa's resistance continues to strengthen. Countries like South Africa, drawing from their own anti-apartheid struggle, are at the forefront of resisting the Israeli apartheid regime. South Africa's genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice further cements Africa's role as a leading advocate for Palestinian liberation. Africa is proving that solidarity with Palestine is more than symbolic. It is a firm commitment to dismantling the Israeli apartheid regime. So how can the International Quds Day be utilized as a powerful platform to advance Nelson Mandela's vision of a free Palestine and turn his call for justice into meaningful action on the global stage?
Africa backs Quds liberation.
Each year on the International Quds Day, large-scale demonstrations take place across Africa in support of Palestine. Home to one-third of the global Muslim population, the continent sees hundreds of thousands joining the worldwide movement advocating for Palestine's liberation. A participant at one of the demonstrations held in the coastal city of Mombasa in Kenya speaks here on the importance of standing with the oppressed people of Palestine.
We should not be ashamed to stand with the oppressors if our hearts are burning, but we keep away from the people who are oppressed. We can't even raise the voices. There's shame on us. We have one thing left on us, and that's our voice. And if we come out, we should claim this occupation no more and not say Israel is a free state, but Israel is a no state. Because it was a usurped land of the Palestinians, given by the British, the Balfour Declaration, gave them land that doesn't belong to them. Why? Because they wanted to get rid of the Jews that were there. Anyway, thank you very much for listening to me, but please, I would request you, echo this out. Remind the people of the world that the oppressed need your voices.
The observance of the International Quds Day, established in 1979 by Imam Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, has become a global tradition of marches and conferences advocating for the Palestinian cause. His appeal for global solidarity continues to resonate worldwide. Africa is part and parcel of this international movement in support of Palestine. Now, let's start off with Dr. Firoz Osman. How has the International Quds Day contributed to raising awareness about the Palestinian liberation struggle across the African continent?
The Iranian Revolution in 1979 was a true revolution. In other words, many of the other revolutions that have taken place did not remove the institutions and the deep state. For example, what happened in Egypt. You know, it lasted a year and then it was overthrown again. And the old systems and the controllers came back in power. So it is probably in recent memory, the only true revolution. And it is quite remarkable for Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, that in 1979, he already declared Al-Quds Day. It showed their determination to free the third most holiest shrine. And it is a day that has been commemorated now ever since 45 years or plus. And it has created a global phenomenon, not only in Africa, as we mentioned, but throughout the world, where Palestine has been brought up into the map. Many others are gaining, given under the current circumstances, what is happening in Gaza, that they are getting courage from what has been happening in Gaza. There is no doubt that, you know, it is Iran that stands against the world system that wants to occupy and oppress people, and it is the Palestinians in Gaza that is fighting the same phenomenon with a great deal of courage, looking to Al-Quds for their liberation, to all countries that are helping them. And in fact, you know, it is the protest marches that began right in Iran in 1979 that continues till this day.
Thanks for that, Dr. Osman. Now let's bring in Hassan Loget. At the 30th African Union Summit held in Addis Ababa last February, African leaders took a strong position against Israel, denouncing its assault on Gaza as genocide and demanding a halt to all cooperation until the Israeli occupation ends. Now, how does Africa's steadfast support for Palestine pose a significant challenge to Netanyahu, who has spent the past decade working to expand Israel's influence across the continent?
The 38th African summit, the AU summit, held in Addis, was very significant because it suggested for the first time that Africa was uniting once again behind Palestine. We have to go back many decades, I think in the early 1980s, when the Organization of African Unity was at its height, trying to create a program for the liberation of the African continent from colonialism and apartheid, that they made a statement in the founding declaration of the African People's Charter, African Charter for Human and People's Rights. And that charter, also known as the Banjul document, was very, very instrumental in putting Zionism as one of the targets. And I wanted to quote a little bit of it. The charter basically said they wanted to achieve the total liberation of Africa, of peoples which are still struggling for their dignity and genuine independence, and undertaking to eliminate colonialism, neocolonialism, apartheid, and Zionism, and to dismantle aggressive foreign military bases and all forms of discrimination, particularly those based on race, ethnic groups, color, sex, language, religion, or political opinion. So it looks like this was a victory for the progressive forces led by South Africa and Algeria.
Ties between the Israeli apartheid regime and the African Union significantly worsen after Israel's assault on Gaza in October 2023, which led to mass atrocities and genocide, resulting in the deaths of over 50,000 Palestinian women and children. Across Africa, people have gathered in massive numbers for rallies in solidarity with Palestine, especially during International Quds Day. These demonstrations impacted the African Union's policy decisions.
The African Union is pivotal. It is important for increasing pressure on the Zionist entity. If we recall way back in 1973, most African countries, almost all bar one or two, broke their ties after the oil embargo in support of the Palestinians, in support of the Arab world. However, the Zionist entity's aim is to bring about a change in Africa, in the African nation states, through the observer status in the African Union. We know a year or two ago that South Africa played a pivotal role to remove the Zionist entity from its observer status in the African Union, despite the fact that some of the African Union member states wanted Israel to be present. You see, what the Zionist state does is to use its soft power, its technology, its military, where they bribe and blackmail and trying to influence the African nation states to support Israel against the Palestinians. And this is where Again, the Iranian Islamic Republic of Iran has played an important role. It is also important for other Muslim nations to be aware of what is happening in parts of Africa and to help the African nations to ward off the soft power that the Zionist entity is using.
Many African countries are actively forging stronger ties with global powers that challenge Western dominance, such as China, Russia, and Iran. These alliances grant them greater political leverage, enabling them to take more independent stances on international matters, including the Palestinian issue. The evolving geopolitical landscape has played a key role in further isolating Israel's apartheid regime in Africa.
Where you find Israel, you'll find conflict. And I think that the countries that want to turn away from conflict have to find a path of peace and are looking for other ways. In the Sahel region, a number of countries have kicked off the leadership military alliances with France. But as I pointed out earlier, we need to negotiate new terms of engagement and relationships with countries like Russia, and so that we do not find ourselves a few years down the line with someone that we cannot live with. We need to live with countries that will affirm African values so that Africa can use its own minerals for its betterment. And we can't replace one set of dictators for another. So yes, getting France out has been strategic, but Africa must renegotiate its terms of engagement with other countries on its own politics, its own agenda that's African-centric. And Kwame Nkrumah was very, very clear that Africa's got a long way to build a United States of Africa where all our resources could be used to uplift our own people.
The comparison between the Israeli regime policies towards Palestinians and the deposed South African apartheid regime has been made by both scholars and political leaders. Now, Dr. Osman, this is for you. In what ways do you see these parallels playing out today, particularly because Western powers, which once supported the apartheid regime in South Africa, are now backing the Israeli apartheid regime?
South Africa under apartheid is exactly the same as apartheid in Israel. And this is said very clearly by our first president, Nelson Mandela. It was said by our moral voice in South Africa, Bishop Tutu. In fact, they didn't say it's exactly the same. They say what is going on in Israel is worse than what has happened in South Africa. That the apartheid there is worse. And we can see it from the genocide. In fact, the Media Review Network commissioned a book, and it is entitled Why Israel? The Anatomy of Zionist Apartheid, a South African Perspective, where it makes very clear the parallels between what was under apartheid in South Africa and what is apartheid in Israel at the moment. And in fact, it's become so obvious that it is no longer a debatable issue. The reason for the support of Zionist apartheid is that the same countries that supported white apartheid racism in South Africa are supporting the Zionist Israeli state, such as Germany, United States of America, Great Britain, France. All of them supported white South Africa until it became untenable, until they could no longer control it and could not stop it. So these are the same racist white settler colonial regimes that are supporting Israel today. And in fact, we can see that what is going on with the Trump administration today, that it is white settler colonialism.
Well, thanks for that, Dr. Osman. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on Africa's solidarity with Palestine as we mark the International Quds Day. Stay with us.
Africa backs Quds liberation.
In late 2023, South Africa filed a case at the International Court of Justice over the Israeli apartheid regime's genocidal war on Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. Ron Lamoda, the current South African foreign minister, speaks here at the ICJ, where he led his country's legal team while serving as the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services. Let's take a listen.
Thank you, Madam President, and distinguished members of the court. It is an honor for me to stand here in front of you on behalf of the Republic of South Africa on this exceptional case. In extending our hands across the miles to the people of Palestine, we do so in full knowledge that we are part of a humanity that is at one. These were the words of our founding president, Nelson Mandela. This is the spirit in which South Africa acceded to the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Crime of Genocide in 1998. This is the spirit in which we approach this court as a contracting party to the Convention. This is a commitment we owe to the people of Palestine and Israelis alike. As previously mentioned, the violence and the destruction in Palestine and Israel did not begin on the 7th of October 2023. The Palestinians have experienced systematic oppression and violence for the last 76 years.
Well, South Africa's case at the International Court of Justice has been described as both a legal and moral stance against the genocide in Gaza. Now, Mr. Logan, this is for you. How significant is this moment for South Africa's history, given its own past with apartheid, and how does it shape its role in global justice and human rights advocacy?
We have to find whatever means possible to preserve a sensible system in the world, a system of equality amongst nations, so that the rule of law, international human rights law, can actually prevail. At present, Trump wants might to rule, not justice, might. And I think South Africa is correct in building these alliances. Our ambassador was declared a persona non grata in America, and Trump has basically asked him to leave the country. This is Ibrahim Rasool, for simply speaking at a web conference in this country, Mistra, where he basically said that Trump and him are fearing the increasing numbers of black and brown peoples in the world, in America, that are beginning to have influence. And he implied that they were trying to preserve white supremacist politics. None of that is untrue, but he's chosen to punish South Africa. So Trump and him are being vindictive, not only to South Africa, but anyone who dared to oppose them, even people in his own party. But South Africa is being bullied. Unfortunately, there are a number of people in our country who actually support Trump, and they happen to be from those who are privileged, happen to be largely white.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Julius Malema, the leader of South Africa's Economic Freedom Fighters Party, frequently takes part in demonstrations backing the Palestinian resistance. In this speech, he expresses his support for Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement. Let's tune in.
What type of a government do we have in Israel that goes and bombs a hospital where people have run away? For refugee, where people are sick, where children are there, where pregnant women are there, you bomb a hospital. And you say you are looking for Hamas, but you are killing innocent children. There is nothing wrong Hamas did. These folk tongues and people speaking in parables and we don't know what they are hearing, what they are saying, it's wrong. When you are oppressed, the only option you have is to fight. And that's what Hamas is doing. They are fighting for their freedom. Mandela did the same thing, took up the guns and fought for the freedom of the people of South Africa. When you are oppressed, you only have one option. Confront the enemy and shoot to kill. Do not kiss the enemy.
South Africa's liberation hero, Nelson Mandela, became known and respected all over the world as a symbol of the struggle against apartheid and all forms of racism. He was steadfast in his support for the liberation of Palestine. He famously stated that, "We know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians."
Mr. Aloga, you have the last word. How can events like the International Courts Day be leveraged as a platform to advance Nelson Mandela's vision of a free Palestine and turn his aspiration into a reality?
When the late president, liberation hero Nelson Mandela, said, "Our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of Palestinians," he basically drew inspiration from the time when the ANC in exile was trained and supported by the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It was a unity built in the trenches. And when he went to America, they tried to ask him to disassociate from Arafat and the PLO and Fatah. And he said, when days were dark and friends were few, only Palestinians, Libya and other countries stood by us while others ignored us. And really, this is the message of Sumud, as the Palestinians say, the steadfastness that Iran and other countries, the Houthis, Lebanon and others, have been very principled in their support for Palestine. Cuba too, they want nothing in return. They support it not because they desire critical minerals, as Trump wants, from the Ukraine. They support it because they believe every nation has a right to determine its own destiny. Every nation has a right to self-determination. And we have fought a long battle, and we are still continuing given the nature of our settlement, and we want to lend a hand so that Palestine one day can be a truly independent state of all its people.
Well, thanks a lot, Hassan Logat and Dr. Firoz Osman, for your incisive analysis. And now we welcome you on Palestine as we mark the International Courts Day.
Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my son, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. I've dug the earth with my hands, my bare hands. I've searched for my roots in this soil, this holy land, the land which is yours and which is mine, Palestine. You, good earth, glorious land, son to you, see, I offer my son to you, only to you. I lifted his head from his mother's arms. I put him on your chest, still in red, to water you. You have my room. It's the story of my anger and your blood. The story of our mother's tears and your brother's cry. Have to take us on, have to take us on. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my dear, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since somebody inside my aching heart, somebody inside our land, our blood joins in sacrifice, sacrifice. Your blood roots me here, this land, your blood, my heart.
And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. On behalf of the entire crew, it's me, Mubarak Kenya, saying goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah. Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of the month of Allah. We're going to be talking about famous reciters of the Quran and the world of Islam. Today, we'll be talking about Brother Muhammad Javad Hosseini, Sayyid Muhammad Javad Hosseini. He is a very famous reciter right now, not only in Iran, but in the whole world. And you can probably watch his videos on YouTube. If you search Muhammad Javad Hosseini, you'll notice that there are a lot of videos of him on the internet and on YouTube. This reciter was born in 1983 in a city close to Mashhad, where the shrine of Imam Ridha is located. He started learning Quran at the age of 11, and his teacher was his brother, Mustafa Hosseini. He started learning the Quran at an early age when he was 11 years old, and his teacher was his brother, Sayyid Hassan Hosseini. Later, in order to learn the other rules of recitation, such as tajweed, maqamat, and waqf wal-ibtida, he became the student of great masters of Quran, such as Mustafa Javidi and Mr. Sadat Fatemi. Brother Sayyid Muhammad Javad Hosseini participated in the Quran competition held in Iran in the year 2009, and he placed first. He won the competition. And this was the very first time that he participated in an international competition. This recitation that we're about to listen to is a recitation which was performed in Madinatul Sadr of Baghdad, which is a district in the city of Baghdad in Iraq. And it's interesting that in this recitation, one of the people in the audience asked Brother Muhammad Javad Hosseini to recite the verses 89 to 90 of Surah Al-Anbiya in Maqam Kurd. He smiled, and then he used Maqam Kurd in this recitation that we're about to listen to. And it's very interesting that someone from the audience requests the reciter to use such and such maqam. And we see this in the recitation performed by Brother Muhammad Javad Hosseini. He uses maqam kurd in the recitation that we're about to listen to right now, which is Suratul Anbiya, verses 89 to 90 by Sayyid Muhammad Javad Hosseini. Let's enjoy this recitation.
Allah and mention Zechariah when he called to his Lord, "My Lord, do not leave me alone with no heir, while you are the best of inheritors." So we responded to him, and we gave to him John, and amended for him his wife. Indeed, they used to hasten to good deeds and supplicate us in hope and fear, and they were to us humbly submissive.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Israeli authorities have released Palestinian filmmaker Hamdan Bilal, a co-director of the Oscar-winning documentary No Other Land, after detaining him overnight. Bilal was in Susia, a village in the occupied West Bank, when a group of Israeli settlers violently attacked him. Despite his injuries, Israeli soldiers arrested him instead of his assailants.
Settlers and army, they attacking my home and they beating me. They continue to beating me. It's like around between 15, 20 minutes until I was bleeding from all my head and face. And finally, after this attack, they took me to the place. I don't know what is it. I stay there. It's like all the night. They was laughing about me.
Bilal was taken into custody and was held overnight before being released.
On Monday, there was a massive attack on Susia village where my friend and colleague and co-director of No Other Land documentary, Hamdan Bilal, lives. There was an attack in his home and other houses in the village. Settlers and soldiers targeted him precisely to revenge against the success of the movie and against Hamdan as an activist in the village that documenting the attacks of the settlers that happening on his village all the time and other villages in Masafer Yatta. This is not an isolated attack. Attacks happening all the time, but this time it was revenge and attack on Hamdan for his success to try to punish him and to silence